Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Remember when Nike dared to use the Beatles song Revolution in its TV ad back in 1987? People had a fit, and the surviving Beatles weren't very happy either, and ended up suing Nike. I mean, using a great old song in a commercial? That was the very definition of selling out, right? Then, in 1989, Honda made a commercial for its scooters, using street scenes of New York and an absolutely classic piece of New York music.
Hey, don't settle for walk.
Yes, that was Lou Reed himself, astride a Honda scooter, as his song Walk on the Wild Side played. Now, that might have been the first time that we, and by we, I mean all of us rock fans for whom selling out was the worst sin you could commit, that might have been the first time we actually stopped and thought, well, that was actually kind of cool. Now, things are so different that Jessica Hopper's recent article is called How Selling Out Saved Indie Rock. We'll talk to her in a bit and ask whether your attitude towards hearing the music you love in a TV commercial has changed over the years. And from England, the vocal trio called Juice joins us to sing a cappella works that go way beyond Glee, including a truly unexpected version of a Guns N' Roses tune. But first, Ann Patchett is the award-winning novelist behind such bestsellers as Bel Canto, The Magician's Assistant, and the recent book State of Wonder. But before her fictional efforts took off, Anne supported herself by writing nonfiction, some of which is collected in her new book, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. And music crops up more than once in these stories and articles. She joins us in the studio with a Pick 3 playlist of favorite songs. Anne Patchett, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So at one point, you recall in one of these essays being a young person thinking about becoming a writer and noting that writers are poor, which struck me as an unusually realistic appraisal of a writer's life, because usually people say, I'll make the Times bestseller list and I'll be optioned for a movie and it's going to be great.
No. And it probably was a combination of my idea of writing, which was really based in La Boheme. I'm going to have a garret and a little stub of a candle, and if I'm super lucky, I'll have a match. And my 12 years of Catholic girls' school and the whole nun thing, the vow of poverty, that if you really loved something, if it came absolutely from your heart, you should be willing to be poor for it.
Mm. Now, you were willing to be poor for it to the extent that you wanted to write fiction, but you weren't willing to be that poor that you weren't willing to support yourself. And that's where the nonfiction comes in.
Well, you know, it's where the practicality comes in, because you have to support yourself. You know, you've got to. You've got to be well enough and stable enough to write the fiction and make the art you love to make.
There's a
roof and electricity.
There's a great old New Yorker cartoon. Maybe you've seen it. It's two pictures of the same guy. In one picture, he's looking out of his front door and it says writer's block, temporary. And in the next panel, it's the same guy and he's looking out of the fish store that he clearly works at, and it says writer's block, permanent.
So, I haven't seen that, I'm going to carry that with me. I love that.
It's pretty good. Is the process of writing fiction and nonfiction different?
Yeah, it is, because fiction is really hard. And the very easiest bit of fiction I've ever written is harder than the hardest bit of nonfiction I've ever written. And it's not that I think fiction is a higher calling or more serious. It is, for me, nonfiction is a snap and fiction is hard.
Mm.
So why don't I just write nonfiction? I really enjoy it, but somehow I think that fiction's more serious because it's hard.
Well, and you're creating the entire universe for your characters.
It's a real pain in the neck. All the trees, all the leaves.
Well, you know, of all the essays in this new collection, I think the one that struck me the most is The Getaway Car, where you talk about writing and the act of writing. And at one point, a woman comes up to you at an event and says, "But everyone has a great novel in them." And you respond, "Well, does everyone have a great,
flower arrangement?
Or does everyone have a great recipe?" And her comeback is, "But everyone's lived a life." As if living a life is the same as having the craft and the art that's involved in writing a novel. So it becomes sort of a meditation on the act of writing.
Because I certainly get her point, but at the end of the day, I don't believe everyone has a great novel in them at all. I mean, any more than I think that they should be able to paint one extraordinary family portrait just because they have a family. But in my life, people are always coming up to me and saying, mostly what they say is, "My daughter wants to be a writer. My next door neighbor, my nephew, my godson. Would you have lunch with him? Would you talk to her on the phone? Would you just see them through this process? I have a question. I want an agent. How do I get a book published? I have one great novel in me. What do I do?" And I thought, I'm going to write this essay, and I am going to make it the clearinghouse of every single thing I know about writing. And then when anyone comes up to me and says, "Will you have lunch with me?" And I do this, and it's worked. This is the best thing I've ever written for my life. I say, "I've got this 50-page essay on writing. It's every single thing I know about the business, the craft, the art, the life, schooling. If you read this essay and you still have something to ask me, I'll have lunch with you." Mm-hmm. And no one has ever come back, maybe because they've been bored to death. No one's ever come back around and said, "Yes, now I want to have lunch with you because I've got 10 more questions."
The story we're talking about, The Getaway Car, is one of the essays in the new compilation called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage by my guest, the novelist Ann Patchett. And so we've asked you to provide us with a playlist. And I think appropriately, we're going to start with this Erik Satie piece, because this is another example of, you know, if you're a budding musician and you look at this music on the page, you think, "Oh my God, that's so simple. I'll be playing this in a month." And you may well be playing it in a month, but you may not be playing it well.
That's right. And this is music that I listened to a lot when I was in college, when I was in graduate school. And it's connected to so many simple piano pieces, the Sanson, and we'll talk about the soundtrack to the movie Diva in a moment. Mm-hmm. But that kind of, it's a lot of stuff that sounds like Satie that is extremely satisfying, peaceful. But then you go back and you listen to Satie and you think, "Oh yeah, this is it."
Let's hear. You like Frank Glaser's recording?
I do.
The American pianist.
I do. Yes.
Of the 20th century. Let's hear the first of the three Gymnopédies by Erik Satie. Just a bit of Frank Glaser's recording of music by Erik Satie, late 19th century French music from the set of three of these Gymnopédies. That's Gymnopédie number one, picked for us by novelist Ann Patchett. Her new book is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, a collection of her nonfiction. Ann will appear at the New York Public Library in the Stephen Schwartzman Building on December 10th in conversation with fellow author Elizabeth Gilbert. And is with us sharing a Pick 3 playlist for us. Now, you've already mentioned La Boheme, and the film Diva.
Yes.
So now people who've read your book, Bel Canto, will know that you are an operaphile.
Yes.
What they may not realize, maybe until they read one of the essays in this book, is that you sort of became an operaphile in the writing of that novel, right?
Oh, absolutely. I knew nothing about opera until I started writing that book, until I decided, well, one of the characters is going to be an opera singer, and then I gave myself a crash course, really fell in love with opera, and then bizarrely became kind of the go-to person where, you know, the Times was saying, oh, Pavarotti, is he going to sing his last Tosca? Let's call Ann Patchett and find out. So I feel like a great opera lover and a great opera fraud all at the same time. But my initial exposure to opera was the movie Diva.
Which, that's like what, early 80s,
yeah,
mid-80s?
Yeah, probably, no, 82 maybe?
Yeah. The big aria from that is from an otherwise totally obscure opera.
Totally obscure and really uninteresting opera. I mean, this is the moment in this opera. I actually feel that way about Rusalka, too. You know, it's an opera with one stunning fall-to-your-knees aria, and the rest of it's kind of like, eh.
That's Dvorak, right?
Dvorak.
The Dvorak opera,
right.
Rusalka. But La Wally was by the Italian composer Alfredo Catalani.
Yes.
And we remember it for this one aria, which in the film, as I recall, that was Wilhelmina Fernandez, but...
Very good. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And when I was picking this, I went back and listened to her singing it. And I listened to Renata Tebaldi singing it because, of course, she owned it. That was her aria. And then I thought, well, you know, the Tebaldi's better. I'm going for that. And then I listened to my pal, Renee, singing it.
Renee Fleming.
And Renee Trumps. In those three, she was the clear and away winner for me.
Now, for folks who aren't aware, in the novel Bel Canto, the opera singer is sort of inspired by Renee Fleming.
No, but that's what everybody says. And actually, I buy it. But I didn't know Renee, and I wasn't that familiar with her work before the book. But we met after the book came out because everybody thought that the book was about her. And here's an interesting little thing. Originally in that book, the character's signature aria was this aria from La Wally.
Really?
And my UK editor said, everybody's going to know that you're just ripping off Diva because you don't know what you're talking about. I said, pick another aria for me. He picked Dvorak's Song to the Moon. From Rusalka. Well, it turns out that Song to the Moon is Renee's signature aria, and that's one of the reasons that everybody thought it was a book about her.
All right. Well, Renee Fleming is the singer here in this aria called Eben ne Andro Lontana from the opera La Wally. Fleming singing the famous aria from the movie Diva. I think that's how many people know it. It's originally from this opera La Wally, an obscure opera by Alfredo Catalani, picked for us by Ann Patchett, sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us. And her new book is a collection of essays and articles, nonfiction articles, called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. You do write about coming to opera, but first, as a Nashville girl, going to the Grand Ole Opry and thinking, not really for me.
No.
So what did you grow up listening to?
I am ashamed to tell you, I did not listen to music. I grew up in a music-free household.
Wow.
And
how's that even possible in the late 60s and 70s?
My stepfather was a crazed surgeon who listened to easy listening music.
Okay.
You remember that?
Yeah.
You know, in the 70s, that's what he listened to. And I grew up thinking music was something that needed to be turned off as soon as possible. If someone turned the radio on, I just wanted it off. And also, I read all the time.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until I went to college and started listening to my roommate's Joni Mitchell records. That was my introduction to music.
Wow.
That's bizarre. I was 17. I had never owned a record album.
Wow. So you learned the truth at 17.
I did. Janice Ian lives down the street from us in Nashville.
Yeah.
She's great.
Yep, she's been on the show. She is great. So do you listen to music while you write?
No, I don't.
Even with Bel Canto, with all the opera in the book, you didn't have that in the...
I listened to a lot of opera while I was working on the book, in terms of doing preparation and research. And there were times, if the character Roxanne Coss was singing a particular aria, I would put that aria on while I was writing it, just to kind of take myself through the notes. But I don't have enough of a brain to listen and to write at the same time.
Well, and many authors who've been on the show have essentially said either they don't listen or they can only listen to instrumental music.
Yes, you could listen to Satie.
Mm-hmm. Because it's very spare, has a lot of space in it.
Yeah.
What about, you know, in the novel State of Wonder, there's a couple of small but key scenes that take place in an opera house in this backwater in central Amazon rainforest in Brazil. It's like, this seems to be something you can't get away from.
No, actually, that scene had to happen for two reasons. One, my biggest Amazonian inspiration, life force, Werner Herzog Fitzgeraldo. And that movie opens in the opera house in Manaus. There was no way I could write about the Amazon without bowing my head to Werner Herzog. And the other thing is, the book was structured, this makes no sense, but a lot on Henry James, the Ambassadors. And the great moment when Chad Newsom is discovered in that book, it's at a box in the opera.
In the opera, yeah.
So after Strether has been looking for him for months, he finds him in the opera box. So for those two reasons, that opera house had to be in the book.
It's a great book, State of Wonder, from my guest Ann Patchett, whose current collection of nonfiction is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. You know, one of the great things about music, I think it's a great thing, some people sort of wrestle with it, is the idea that you as a songwriter may have an idea of what you're writing about, but every listener is going to bring their own interpretation to it.
It's much like writing a novel.
I was just going to say, the Renee Fleming thing with Bel Canto. I mean, you can't stop us all from thinking, that's clearly Renee Fleming.
That's right. Yeah. And that becomes true. Because if that's what you think, if that's what you read, then that is the truth.
Right.
I haven't read that book since I wrote it, and I finished it in 2000. I don't know. I don't have any opinion anymore. It's your book. It's not mine.
It's often that way with music. And sometimes it's that way with stories that you tell that maybe even aren't fiction. And there are a couple of different stories, related stories in this collection, that deal with Clemson University. Is there a thumbnail way, a Reader's Digest condensed version of this that you can tell us?
Sure. Colleges, universities like to have an all freshman read. They pick one book, the whole class reads the book, they bring the author in. I do this all the time. Clemson invited me to come in with Truth and Beauty, which is a nonfiction account of my friendship with Lucy Greeley, who died at the age of 39 of a heroin overdose after a lifetime of medical problems. And when I got there, I was picketed, and the book was called Pornography. Again, I had been invited. I was not begging Clemson to read my book, but there was a huge public outcry that was really put up by one man named Ken Wingate, who was just trying to get on the news every night. He was running a political campaign, and he was saying, you know, we have to save our students.
He'd already lost two
political campaigns. We've got to save the students, the good moral students of Clemson, from this smut. And I like to think that I always get the last word, and I get my last word in The Atlantic. So after I got through that really horrifying experience. They gave me a bodyguard when I was giving the convocation address. It was bad. And what you realize is that really 95% of the people can be for you, but all you need is one nut job with a baseball bat, and you're really in trouble. And that was my experience.
Well, also, this guy had sort of taken out of the story sort of key sentences completely out of context and sort of strung them together and sent them to people saying, this is what your freshman sons and daughters are going to be reading.
That's reading. That's right. He took out any sentence where there was a mention of drugs, alcohol, sex, or profanity, strung them all together on one page, and then just did an email blast to the world and said, I will save you from having to trudge through the sewer that I had to go through. Here you can just read the one-page Glyph Notes. My favorite line in that was, it said at the top, praise for truth and beauty, not universal. That's something I have really carried with me.
All right, let's talk about something that has a bit of truth and beauty to it, which is the gospel at Colonus.
Oh.
This was Bob Telson and Lee Brewer, Lee Brewer of Mabu Mines, Bob Telson, noted singer-songwriter, keyboardist. They did this here in New York in the mid-1980s, and it was such a wonderful production. It's basically a retelling of Sophocles, or of Oedipus and Colonus,
yes. And it was a piece of music that I got when I was in graduate school in Iowa, which would have been 1985. Is that about when it
That's
came
about
out?
When it happened, yeah.
And I had my cassette tape and my Walkman, and every morning when I would go to class in the snow, in Iowa, in the dark, it's 30 below, I would listen to this music every day. It really became my religion. It's such stirring, powerful, beautiful, beautiful music, and it's completely fresh.
Mm-hmm.
It just stays like any great gospel is. It doesn't age.
So you had like the Five Blind Boys of Alabama, as they were then known. They were here just a week or so ago. They've dropped the five, but still the Blind Boys of Alabama, Javetta Steele, all these great gospel singers.
Yes.
What song did you pick?
I picked Numberless Are the World's Wonders, but I have to tell you, it was a struggle. I changed my mind about five times and then came back. This was my first choice. And I also want to say, really important to get the original cast recording, because there have been some other recordings that are good, but not as good.
Bob Telson and Lee Brewer with The Gospel at Colonus, picked for us by novelist Ann Patchett.
Are the world's wonders, but none more wonderful than man. The storm gray seas yield to his prows, huge crest is graven where his plows have gone.
Numberless are the world's wonders, from The Gospel at Colonus by Bob Telson and Lee Brewer, and featuring some great gospel singers. Ann Patchett, the author of, among other things, Bel Canto and State of Wonder, and the new collection called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck today. And great to see you again.
Great to see you. Thank you so much.
Up next, a look at the rise of advertising dollars in the world of independent music. And later, the music of Axl Rose as you've never heard it before. The English group Juice takes on Guns N' Roses later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you're a football fan like me, then you probably spend way too much time in front of the TV on Sundays, and you certainly would have heard this song a lot. A couple of years ago, the band Phoenix licensed this song for a Cadillac commercial that seemed to be playing constantly during football season. And you know what? No one cried foul. How Selling Out Saved Indie Rock is the title of Jessica Hopper's new article for BuzzFeed. Jessica is a contributing editor for Rookie Mag and joins us on the line. Jessica, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So back in, you know, the 80s, the 90s, etc., if you heard a band you really liked having their song played on a TV commercial, you know, it would have been met with a chorus of cries of sell out, sell out. Why is that not happening anymore?
Well, part of it is just that it's totally commonplace at this point. One of the things that has driven this change to make it a lot more acceptable is just that everyone's doing it. And this is basically one of the last few places bands can make quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm. Define quite a bit.
Well, you know, the lowest numbers I heard were, you know, low thousands, might be for something that's just a small online campaign, to about $360,000 for an original song for a 2-year campaign for a well-known independent act.
Mm-hmm. In your article, you talked with one ad exec who was all excited because they got Lorde's first single, the 17-year-old New Zealander. Her single Royals, which has been number one on the singles chart for a number of weeks now, licensed for a Samsung commercial. Why is that a big deal to get to her first? Is there a kind of element of discovery in this?
No, I think it was more just to be first to it. It's considered the kind of a get.
Let's hear the song Royals from Lorde, now licensed for this big Samsung commercial.
And we'll never be royal.
Royals.
It's a one in our blood. That kind of love just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler.
Ruler.
That is the song Royals by Lorde, a 17-year-old singer from New Zealand who's had the number one single in this country for a number of weeks now. Jessica Hopper, her article for BuzzFeed is called How Selling Out Saved Indie Rock, How All These Musicians Are Now Finding Revenue Streams in Advertising That They're No Longer Finding in Record Sales and Things Like That. Is there, isn't there something ironic about this song with its kind of sending up of commercial culture being used in a commercial?
Certainly. I mean, also in the commercial where it is used, it's seeming to be sung by a bunch of sort of rascally little dirty children. So there's sort of multiple layers to that particular sink.
Yeah.
If a song is big, sinks can mean a little bit less for that artist. But typically for younger artists now, this is one of the most proven ways for discovery. And in the article, I talk about how if an artist is teed up, someone like Fun, someone like Tegan and Sarah, if you're sort of teed up, a sync can be the thing that sort of bats you over into the mainstream.
So in fact, you mentioned Tegan and Sarah. In the article, we see them playing essentially a private concert for these ad agencies, the people who make those decisions.
It is a very common thing to make those rounds when you are doing your tour.
Now, we had Tegan and Sarah on the show during the summer this year, and they talked about exactly this and how they found this attempt to get a wider audience to be actually a kind of empowering thing.
A lot of our record, The Con, actually, people were like, if it had just, you know, been pushed a little bit further, you know, those would have been potentially radio-friendly songs. And we'd always just said, no, there's no room for us on radio. We're different. We're girls. We write our own songs. Nobody wants that. No one wants that. And all of a sudden, we didn't care anymore. We were like shrugged off all that insecurity. And I was like, I want to change the way that mainstream radio looks. I want to change the way that mainstream music looks. I want to get things like SNL. I want to get on the Ellen Show. I want to tour and play really big venues. And I don't want to compromise. I want to just go for it. And still have integrity in our music. And Sarah was on board for that, too. She was really pushing for a pop record anyway.
You're only meant to hurt once in a while. Who gave you reason? You're only
So the Tegan and Sara with Shock to Your System was the song they ended up licensing as a result of one of these, I guess we'll call them auditions, right? I mean, these private concerts that they do for ad agencies and music supervisors.
They are considered to be showcases, technically.
Showcases, okay. We're speaking with Jessica Hopper. She's a music editor for Rookie Mag and has contributed this article to BuzzFeed called How Selling Out Saved Indie Rock. Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? Has your kind of feeling about hearing music, maybe from a favorite band, on a TV commercial, has that changed? Has your kind of response to that changed over the years? You can leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or tweet us at Soundcheck, or leave a comment on our website at soundcheck.org. Jessica, you make the case that these advertising agencies, they're the new record labels. But do listeners make that connection?
Less so. It's really about how the sort of purpose and function they now serve, and that it gives bands the kind of money that is no longer there in terms of record deals or mm-hmm. record sales, or even for a lot of bands touring.
So as you look back at this trend, which has now been going on for quite a number of years, are there certain kind of landmark, you know, greatest hits? You write in the article about Lou Reed, for example, with the motor scooter commercial.
Some of the ones that came up a lot were the VW's use of Pink Moon, which a lot of people said that was their method for discovery about Nick Drake, mm-hmm. but also that you could have cool music in a commercial.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way.
And another one that's mentioned in the piece is Osni Tontes in the McDonald's commercial. But at this point, it's become so, I mean, you can cite a million things, a million songs, thousands of songs even, that kind of helped break down the stigma and the barrier. And once it was more than just cool bands and it was just every band. Mm-hmm. But the major one I would say that people bring up is Pink Moon.
Well, I remember when that TV commercial came out, and I was not, you know, my wife had the TV on and I was in the other room and I heard Nick Drake. I came running in and I was like, what are you watching? And it was a TV commercial. And to my own surprise, my reaction was, oh, that's so cool. You know, and as I thought that, I also thought, why am I thinking that? I should be saying, this is awful. It shouldn't be here. But it just seemed like such a great thing because, as you say, it was great exposure for many people to Nick Drake's mm-hmm. songs. Has this turned out to be kind of a silver bullet for a lot of struggling bands? I mean, can placement on a big television ad campaign really catapult a band to the next level?
For some bands, yes. Many people said in the piece, it's, you know, the right song and the right commercial is something you can't manufacture. For some bands, especially small bands, you know, it is a chance to buy a van or have a lump sum of cash to bankroll a recording or to take tours that are less than profitable that they couldn't otherwise do. But as noted in the article, all these bands saying yes has driven prices down. And so the market is flooded and prices have just continued to fall from 20 years ago and they're just going down and down. So the life raft sort of has a hole in it.
Now, you also talk about a kind of unsung, unseen part of the industry, groups or companies like Black Iris, which is essentially a bunch of musicians whose day job is to compose music for commercials, to bring musicians together with ad agencies and things like that. And some of these people have like actual name recognition in the music community, and some of them, including a singer you spoke to, did not want her name used. What did you make of that?
Mm-hmm. you know, the divide that I found when I was reporting this story, and I reported it for 50 weeks, almost a year, was that people over the age of 35 still felt a little weird and embarrassed by it, unless they were fully in the throes of it. People who worked at music houses are very unapologetic about what it is that they're doing. They see it for what it is. And but artists and people would be shocked by some of the names that I could name of people who behind the scenes sing in commercials, people from huge bands that are deeply aligned with, you know, DIY and underground scenes in America, singing and playing on commercials anonymously.
Mm-hmm. So for some people, that stigma of selling out still apparently exists.
Yes, but it really was, you know, the divide was basically if you were 35 or older, it was a little ooky for you. If you were younger, the younger you were, the more commonplace, the more exciting it was, and that there was kind of no bones about it because it had just been like that as long as these kids had been alive.
Well, now, and this music house that you cover in the article, Black Iris, they actually have their own record label called White Iris. So they're producing, you know, quote unquote, real music and releasing it into the marketplace as well. The article is called How Selling Out Saved Indie Rock. Jessica Hopper's been talking with us. She wrote the article for BuzzFeed. Soundcheck listeners, is it still kind of ooky for you? Is it still a sellout? Or has your opinion changed about using music in ads? Give us a call at 866-939-1612 or leave us a comment on our website at soundcheck.org. Jessica, we're actually going to wrap up with this this Black Iris-produced commercial, the Swagger Wagon. This kind of become their calling card, hasn't it?
Yes, and it includes people who are names within, you know, American punk underground scene.
Yeah, this one goes out to all you minivan families out there. Sienna SE in the house.
Jessica, nice talking to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Where my kids at? Where my kids at? Where my kids at? Where my kids at? Where my kids at?
No, seriously, honey, where are the kids?
They're right there, see?
Oh, cool beans.
I roll hard through the streets and the cul-de-sacs. Proud parent of an honor roll student, Jack. I got a swing in the front, a tree house in the back. My number one dad mug says, yeah, I'm the Mac.
I'm the world's best nurse when my kids get sick. I make a mean gel mold, I perfected my tricks. Back when I used to party as a college chick, now I'm cruising to their play dates looking all slick.
In my swagger wagon, yeah, the swagger wagon, it's the swagger wagon. I got the pride in my ride in my swagger wagon, yeah, the swagger wagon, it's the swagger wagon. Check it, I love hanging with my daughter, sipping tea, keep my pinky up. All the drawings on my fridge sport an A+. I'm an awesome parent,
right?
And it's apparent.
True.
And in this house there's no mother father swearing.
Straight owning bake sales with my cupcake skills. I'm better with the money, so I handle the bills. And I always buy in bulk, ain't afraid of no spills.
Up next, Juice is the name of an English vocal trio that sings contemporary works, including succulent arrangements of Mariah Carey, Kraftwerk, and Guns N' Roses. Juice is next on Soundcheck.
You know what you want to be, and what you always be. Find out what you do, what you find out what you do, find out what you do. You know what you want to be, and you always be. Find out what you do, find out what you do, find out what you do. You know what you want to be, and always be. Find out what you do, find out what you do, find out what you do.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And if there's something vaguely familiar about this music, well, it was a huge hit in the 90s for Mariah Carey. But this is the English vocal trio called Juice, doing their own arrangement of the song Always Be My Baby. The group has gained fans and an independent music award for its work with contemporary classical music, but that hasn't stopped them from taking on old English folk songs and modern pop music. With inspiration drawn from Björk and the American experimental vocalist Meredith Monk, from hip-hop and from electronic music, they do it all with just three voices. And they're going to start us off with their arrangement of the Guns N' Roses song Sweet Child of Mine. It's the Juice Vocal Ensemble, live on Soundcheck.
way to that special place. And if I stay too long, I'd probably break down and cry. Oh, sweet child. Oh, sweet child. Da, 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 da. She's got eyes of the bluest skies, as if they thought of rain. I hate to look into those eyes and see.
That is Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine in an arrangement and live performance by the Juice Vocal Ensemble here in our New York studio from England. Let me introduce you to the three members of Juice. Kerry Andrew is the group's alto.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're at the bottom end of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
The sopranos are Sarah Dacey.
Hello.
Sarah. And Anna Snow.
Hello.
So, Anna, you and Sarah are the sort of the birds. You're the aviary in that version. And then, Kerry, you're sort of singing the tune,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who does these, when you do these arrangements of pop songs, whether it's Guns N' Roses or Mariah Carey, or I know you're working up Kraftwerk and people like that, what are you guys trying to do with these songs?
make them unusual, interesting vocally, sort of just a bit different.
We're aware that, you know, that obviously a lot of a cappella groups, this is their world. They take pop songs and they make them into purely vocal arrangements. Mm-hmm. And so we like to consider ourselves somewhere between an a cappella group and a contemporary classical group.
Right.
So we're very much looking to do something different that hopefully most a cappella groups wouldn't think to do.
Is the Glee thing a big phenomenon on your side of the Atlantic?
It's a lot smaller than it is here. I think it's slowly catching on.
Right. But, you know, every college, it seems, here in the States has at least one and possibly more than one a cappella groups. It's become a thing.
I think it's a lot more in terms of, it relates to the music departments at universities. They may have small groups within that, but nothing as large as it is here, and a lot more staid as well.
Yeah, the standard, we were at Wesleyan University last week and we coached some a cappella groups. And the standard for us was amazing, actually. So
there's
really nothing like that in the UK.
No. Mm-hmm. Now, you guys are part of London's non-classical community.
Yeah.
I mean, non-classical is the name of both a record label and it's a nightclub in East London, right?
Yes.
Founded by Gabriel Prokofiev, who is Sergei Prokofiev, the great Russian composer, his grandson.
Yep.
So is this, I mean, just the name non-classical, and you guys seem to fit that name really well, is it about bringing sort of classical music to the same place at the table as all the other genres?
Absolutely. It's about broadening people's horizons and bringing in lots of other kinds of music into the classical world as well as spreading it out the other way. So, and I think that's kind of our mantra as well. We do classical music, but we do lots of other things as well. It's all music to me.
We do sing some sort of pretty folk songs. There's one of those coming up. But normally we like to take a piece of music from any genre and do the juice thing, I guess.
And what is the juice thing?
is using our three voices in interesting ways, no holds barred.
Mm-hmm.
Drawing on extra vocal techniques, the things that you do outside conventional singing, beatboxing, world music techniques. I mean, anything goes, really.
Right. Okay. So there's the influence of electronic music in some of your pieces, even though it's just three voices, acoustic. There are also some remixes on the first record you guys did, which is called Song Spin, and which is out now. And you're working on a new record, right, called Laid Bare, which is due on Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So is that intentional?
Yes, it is.
So do we expect to hear love songs, or is this kind of the juice version of love songs?
It is the juice version of love songs. We had a big commissioning project a couple of years ago. It's 2010, and we commissioned 10 very different composers. We're actually going to sing Jim Moray's one in a minute, but and he chose to set a traditional song. The album is love songs, but with sort of our juice take, and some of the covers arrangements we've done ourselves will be on there as well.
All right, Annie, you mentioned this Jim Murray piece, Moray. It looks like Moray.
Moray.
But when he was here, he pronounced his name Murray.
Oh, no.
We've
been
saying it
for all these years.
I mean,
sorry,
it's like,
Jim.
Okay, Jim, it's your name. I'll say Murray if that's what you want. He's a terrific folk singer and songwriter. So this song called The Unquiet Grave, this is his arrangement?
Yeah, it's a traditional song. Mm-hmm. It's got, we're not sure if it's English or Irish roots. Jim could tell us. But it was updated, as these songs often are, updated after the First World War. So the story is that a girl is by the grave of her soldier love who has died. If you listen to the song, you'll hear the rest of the story.
We will listen to the song right now, in fact. The band is Juice Vocal Ensemble from England, here in our New York studio. Let's hear their performance of The Unquiet Grave, traditional song arranged by Jim Murray, live on Soundcheck.
Does blow today, my love, and softly falls the rain. I never had but one true love, in a cold grave he lies slain. I'll do as much for my true love as any young girl may. I'll sit and mourn all I that is grey for 12 months and a day. 12 months and a day. 12 months and a day. I'll sit and mourn all that is grey for 12 months and a day. My true love's face was porcelain fair, his eyes of emerald green, his body like a waxwork there, no equal could be seen. They sent him off to Flanders fields, or danger to defy, and soon his blood it stained the field that used to grow so high. But 12 months and a day being up, the dead began to speak. Who sits there weeping at my grave and will not let me sleep? It's I who sits there at your grave and will not let you rest. I crave one kiss of your cold clay lips and to hold you to my breast. If you'd one kiss of my cold clay lips, your time would not be long. So make yourself content, my love, till angels call you home. So make yourself content, my love, till angels call you home. For life is only short, my dear, but love will linger on. But 12 months and a day being up, my time on earth is done. And all around was whispering rain, and she was left alone.
That is called The Unquiet Grave, an arrangement of a traditional folk song and ghost story, as it happens, by England's Jim Murray, performed live here in the studio by the group for whom he did this arrangement, the Juice Vocal Ensemble. Their album is called Songspin, the current album. It is out now. And there are, Sarah, there are a bunch of remixes on that album. Why is that a kind of an important part of what the group does?
Gabriel works as a DJ.
That's Gabriel Prokofiev, the founder of the non-classical label.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was kind of part of what he wanted to do with the label, was that you have classical music, but then you remix it and take it to a street level, as it were, and dirty up a little bit. So that's what he does with every CD, more or less. So,
I think particularly because we've been working with someone who did a remix for us on the album, Magica, who's a wonderful producer and vocalist and body percussionist. And we've worked with him over the last year or two, and he comes from that world, from the sort of producing world, and he's got us thinking about the colours a lot more.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, if you go to our webpage, to soundcheck.org, you will see the version you guys did of Rihanna's Only Girl in the World with Magica.
Yeah.
The video of that is on our website now at soundcheck.org. It's been great having you guys with us here in the Soundcheck studio today.
Thank you so much.
The Juice Vocal Ensemble on Soundcheck.
It's the
Well, there's more where this came from. Juice recorded an extra song, and you can hear the whole session on our website at soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, a visit from the blues guitar prodigy Gary Clark Jr. He's played at the White House, with the Rolling Stones, at the Glastonbury Festival, and tomorrow he'll play in our studio, just for you. Plus, the violent world of Mexican drug gangs has shaped pop culture and an entire genre of music. We'll hear about the new documentary Narcocultura. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff, with Isaac Davey Aronson, Amy Pearl, Krista Ripple, and our intern, Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. That does it for the show today. This is Soundcheck.